Tell me the truth. Welcome to Between the Lines on WGXE at 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. This is a somewhat bittersweet program for me, as it's my swan song. After almost 4 years, this will be my last monthly broadcast as host of this program. But more of that later. First, an interview I recorded earlier in the month.
The bird in your mouth for what you say, and pieces of paper in the way, 'cause I can't continue pretending to choose these opposite sides on which we fall, loving you later if at all.
And you're listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. And my guest today is Elaine Fernandez, who's the founder of the new Hudson Valley Playwrights Group that serves as a workshop and creative venue for local playwrights and that operates out of the Morton Memorial Library in Rhinecliffe. The playwrights will be presenting their first stage productions of 10-minute plays and monologues on January 17th and 18th as a benefit for the library. And later on, they'll be involved in a short play festival at the Centre for the Performing Arts in Rhinebeck. So welcome to Between the Lines, Eileen.
Thank you very much.
Now, you were born and raised in Rhinecliffe, and you also have a very storied career in human services and government. You've won many awards, but more of that later. But first, what exactly is the Hudson Valley Playwrights Group?
It's basically a group of playwrights, or at least it started out as a group of playwrights, local playwrights, people who live in the Hudson Valley, who are looking for an opportunity to have an environment that is both supportive and helps to keep them disciplined so they stay on track writing. I started this group earlier in the year in June after taking a playwriting course that was offered by Paul Cooper in Kingston, and I really enjoyed the playwriting course, and there were a lot of us who would meet weekly there, and we would work on our plays together. And I realized when the course was over, after several months, that I really liked the environment because it was very supportive, very creative, obviously, with all of these writers sharing their work together. And I felt like I wanted an opportunity to stay disciplined. When I was in the class, when you have work you have to submit every week and you know you're going to be discussing it, it keeps you disciplined. You have no choice. And part of my fear with finishing that was that I wouldn't have that same level of discipline if I was just completely left on my own. And so that's what started Hudson Valley Playwrights.
Right, and I think it's a great idea, the idea of discipline, because as a playwright myself, I know very well, and also as a journalist, I write to a deadline. So I think you're providing a fantastic service here. Now, is it just for professionals or amateurs or what?
It's actually for both. I mean, I myself am an amateur, and so for me, when I started this group, I wanted it to be open to all creatives, people who, you know, may be writing for years, but they never published it, they never performed it, they don't necessarily know all the rules to publish or perform. I know that I've been writing since I was very, very young. I think my parents told me I was about 9 years old when I wrote my first short story, and it was about a runaway. And although I don't remember that story, my parents do, but I do remember always loving writing. I mean, since I was very young, I just loved to write. I wrote a lot of poetry in my 30s. I used to write scripts when I was very young. Same place where we have the workshops right now at the Morton Library. The stage was used there a lot when I was a kid growing up in Rhinecliffe. And I remember all the plays being performed there. And I used to, for fun, just write little skits, thinking that they would be performed there at some point. And when I worked at Santa Fe Restaurant for many years, I was waiting tables there while I was in college. That's how I put myself through school. There were a group of us there that formed a little comedy club, and we started writing comedy skits. And so it's something that's in my blood and bones, something I really love to do, but I've never really said to myself, okay, I'm going to do this with the intent of either publishing my work, producing my work, performing my work, where now I feel like I'm ready for that commitment.
It takes an enormous amount of time and effort and energy to run a workshop, because this one is weekly. And it's also a very structured workshop.
So one of the things I realized when I knew I wanted to start a playwriting group when the courses were ending earlier this year was that I had no clue where to begin. I had never done anything like this. I really didn't know people who had. And so I went online and I did a lot of research looking at different groups that offered playwriting workshops. And I found one in New York City, the Workshop Theater. And I was really impressed. They've won awards. They seemed very structured and organized. And I contacted them, and they've been very generous with their time and their advice and explaining to me how I could begin the process. And one of the things I asked them was, how do you go about choosing, like, what gets read, how many pages get read, do you do full readings? And they said to start with 10 pages. That was part of their model, was scene readings, and a scene is typically about 10 pages. And so I sort of adopted their model. And what they based their model on is something called the critical response process, which was a method developed by Liz Lehrman. And the way the critical response process works is that it starts off with the reading takes place, so you have your 10 pages. And then it begins with getting reactions from the audience, from the people listening, in our case, other playwrights, their reactions to what they just heard. So, you know, that was very original, or that was very dark, that was very interesting, whatever their reaction was to the work. And then it opens up to the playwright to ask questions, anything that they may wonder about with their script. Is, am I on the right track? Was anything confusing? Whatever their question may be. And then it gets opened up to the audience, the playwrights, to ask questions, to say whatever questions they may have about the work they just heard. And then the fourth part of the process is an opinion part of the process. And one of the things that really drew me to the critical response process, and one of the reasons that I chose this group to model our group after, is the fact that it's very supportive. So rather than somebody saying, I think that's terrible, I don't know why you wrote that, which I've actually heard has happened in other workshops, much to my horror and surprise, instead it goes from, it comes from a place where it's supportive in that people, they want to be able to tell you where there may be gaps or problems in the work, because the idea is to help you and to be successful with your work. And so it's geared toward questions that are productive. So if you have a main character that, you know, suddenly comes out in, you know, act three that they never saw before, but this character has a major role, somebody identifies that, that's a positive, productive thing to identify. If it's a major character, maybe you want to introduce them earlier, or did you mean, you know, that kind of thing versus...
Yeah. Constructive criticism, in other words. Yeah.
That's exactly right. Exactly. It's meant to be constructive and helpful to keep the writer writing. It's the idea is not to shut writers down. And it's a very vulnerable place to be as a writer. I mean, any writer can tell you that. Even the most experienced writers will say that. And I certainly know that's true for myself, being an amateur and very new at all of this. And so I think it's really important not to close that door on other people, to have an environment where you can help that person with the kind of information that will make them want to go back and write more to either their next scene or to work on that scene where there may have been problems, but to keep the writer writing.
Now, the first fruits of your labor, as it were, will be seen on January the 17th and 18th. So what will people see? What kind of productions are you staging?
Well, we thought it would be best because, I mean, we only formed in June, so, you know, really to be already doing performances in January is a pretty short amount of time. So we thought it would be best to start with staged readings, where people are doing seated staged readings, and no more than 10 minutes. So either a 10-minute play or a monologue that falls within that 10-minute guideline. And so we have 13 playwrights all together. We have six that will be performing on Saturday. Well, I should say that we'll have their plays read and performed on Saturday. And then seven that will have their plays read on Sunday. So there'll be different plays on both days. But it's very exciting. We have some really good plays in the mix, really interesting work.
Because you've gone out and you've not only had the playwrights present, but you've recruited actors as well.
Yes. In fact, when you asked earlier what Hudson Valley playwrights, who they are, we started off as a group of playwrights and we would read each other's work. And, you know, we all realized before too long that it would be beneficial to the group and to have actors present and even directors. And we do have a couple of directors, but we're very short on actors. So I've actually made a real effort to reach out and find actors who might be interested. Other playwrights in the group have as well. Some already had connections to some good actors. So slowly we've built this pool now of stock actors. We have about four or five stock actors now.
And how many people are involved in this group?
I would say, well, even just judging by the Morton event coming up, we have those 13 playwrights that are very committed. But even in addition to those playwrights, we have others that would have been a part of the Morton performances, but they couldn't for one reason or another. So I would say we have between 15 and 20 really committed playwrights who show up regularly with scenes to be read.
Are you open to more people joining, or is there a kind of a cutoff number?
I am open to other people joining. Of course, you know, it is a little problematic in the sense that as it is, we don't get the scenes right as frequently, all of the writers as they would like, because, you know, everybody has to get a turn before somebody else can go twice. So this way everybody has an opportunity to have their scenes read. The only rules we have is that if somebody wants to join the group, that they're committed to the group. In other words, they don't just show up for their own readings. They show up for everybody's readings. They come on time, they stay for the duration, and so that they participate in everybody's success. Now, that being said, of course, there are times when people can't be there, or they need to come in late, or they need to leave early. I mean, that's normal. That's understandable. But we're looking for people who are clearly committed. And just by the people that we have, the 15 to 20 that I just mentioned, all of those people are very committed.
Now, if people show up to this event, what are they likely to see? Can you describe some of the plays, or just give us a little bit of a preview?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the six plays that are showing on Saturday, those performances will be between 7:30 and 9:30 p.m. And we have one show called Labradors in Heat by Wally Carbone, and it's about two dogs trying to come to terms with the death of a friend. We have another play called 10 Minutes by Paul Cooper, where a husband offers his wife, who's desperate for quality time, only 10 minutes. We have a comedy called Waxer by Carol Elkins, and it's about a bored housewife and vacuum cleaner salesman who embark on a curious adventure that ends rather abruptly. We have many more. We have another called Need Not Apply by Lisa Kimball. It's about a deli owner who displays a sign outside his store that reads, "Now hiring Mexicans, Puerto Ricans need not apply," in an attempt to teach his irresponsible but attractive Puerto Rican employee a lesson. And this is an interesting one because it's actually based on a true story. She got this idea from a newspaper article, and she turned it into a great short play. We have the others, just to give you some titles: A Day in Saratoga, another comedy, Blue Skies, Tall Tales, my own play called Almost Home. We have an awesome one called Sex at 70, very, very funny.
I'm laughing already.
it's a great play too. It's very it's very emotional. When she did the reading, you could hear a pin drop in the room. It was really just beautiful. You went through a range of emotions through the whole story, and there were times when you laughed, there were times when you were just deadpan quiet, thinking and listening. I mean, all of these plays are just, I have to say, this has been a real highlight for me in my own personal life in terms of the development of this group. And then we have a couple of others, one called The H Word, which is also hilarious, by Karen Rich. And we have another one about a Christmas list. It's called The List by Bill Duncan. So there's a variety of comedy, drama, but they're all really fantastic short plays.
And you yourself have a play in the Sunday event, correct?
Yep, I do. I have a play. It's called Almost Home. And my play is about an abusive aging husband who thinks he's going for a routine doctor's appointment, but his wife has other plans for him.
Okay, so it sounds like there's something for everyone there. And you're listening to Between the Lines. I'm Anne Forbes Cooper, and we're here with Elaine Fernandez. How do you find the time to do all this? You are involved in so many other activities. You have a job. You're on the Rhinebeck Council?
I'm a council person for the Rhinebeck Town Board. Yes, that's not full-time. It's part-time, although I'm finding that the more I'm learning, the more time I'm spending, because I can be more useful as I'm understanding local government better. I've been doing that since January. I was elected last year. But I've worked full-time. I work for Senator Terry Gibson in Poughkeepsie. And I've been with him since he took office in 2013 on January 1st. And prior to that, I worked for the state legislature for 6 years.
And what inspires you? What is it that motivates you? I mean, you're involved in so many things. You've been involved with the community in many ways. You work with the aging. You work on other community levels.
What inspires me? I think more than anything, it's a combination of my human services and government experience. I know in my full-length play I'm working on right now, it's a play called You're Not Welcome Here, and it's a drama based on a true story about a family losing their home. A lot of the things that I want to write about in the future and the things I'm working on now, the longer pieces, have to do with my experience working in government and human services. A lot of my work will be based on real life stories. My short play, the Almost Home, was more of sort of it was a fun exercise for me more than anything. I'm finding it more difficult right now for myself as a writer to find a way to turn my human services experience into short plays, which I do want to do, but I'm finding it easier to do that with longer plays because I feel like there's just so much to get out there. But so that's really what inspires me. I think it's a combination of being a writer since I was very young and being so involved in human services, and even working in government. My 6 years in the legislature, I worked as a social policy analyst, and now for the senator, I'm his director of human services. So even in government, I've worked in human services. So it's very much a part of who I am, very much a part of my life. I've been a volunteer all my life. I've been exposed to a lot. And I think that's the bulk of what I want to write about. That's mostly what I care to write about.
And you're involved in many different mediums. You made a film called We the People about the effects of the 2008 recession.
Actually, it wasn't a film. It was a blog that called WeThePeople.com. And what I did was I spent a year touring New York State, interviewing people at job fairs, people that were homeless, people standing on the social services line, people anywhere, and I could get a captive audience. Anybody who agreed to talk about their life since the recession, any concerns they had, how they were faring. I interviewed seniors, small business people, and so I would post the short videos on my blog, WeThePeople.com, which I no longer have the blog. It's no longer active, but I did put a few of the video samples on my website, which is www.elainefernandez.me. So I do have some samples there, but I took the blog down because I wasn't posting on it any longer.
And what was the impact of this? What did you want the impact to be?
I wanted people to have a voice. I wanted people who were frightened, people who were affected, people who were concerned to have a voice. There are a lot of people, and I've learned this firsthand in human services with the people that I've worked with over the years, that feel they don't have a voice. And they have a lot to contribute. And I think I thought it was an important thing at the time, too, to be able to post in the hope that government would find out about some of the videos, people in government, people that had the ability to do something about what was happening, or at least to recognize and understand how broad the impact was and how people in particular were suffering since the recession.
Did they find out about it?
You know, that's a really funny question. Interestingly, they did. And one way I found out was that one person that I interviewed, she had a jam-making business, and she had a home processing license. And according to that license, you were not allowed to use the website to sell or promote your product. And because when I did my video interview with her, we did a picture of her jam bottle on the front, but it was just as a photo, a picture sort of introducing the video that was about to be shown. And the federal government found out about it and told her she had to take it down. So I had to actually redo the video and take the jam bottle out. So that was my first, yeah, exactly. It was a kind of interesting way to find out that some people were actually paying attention to this. I'm not sure all the ones I wanted to were, but.
Yes. Yeah, both a bad thing and a good thing. It was around that time that you also were briefly involved with WGXC.
Yes, yes. I love WGXC. I was really excited about the idea of community radio. I mean, anything community has always been interesting and appealing to me. Those are the things I'm drawn to. And so when I heard about WGXC and they were starting up and they needed people, at the time I was unemployed and I was very interested in seeing how I could help out. So I briefly did a little bit of hosting and helped where I could.
It should be pointed out that you're very much a local person. You were born and bred in Rhinecliff, right? And you live in your parents' house, or you live in the house that you grew up in.
Well, okay, so almost. Yes, I was born and raised in Rhinecliff. I live down the road from my parents. My parents own 4 homes in Rhinecliff. So I live in one of their homes. So I live down the road from them. So they still live in the house I grew up in, and I visit with them frequently, which is really nice. I have a very, very close family. My sisters live nearby. My aunts live nearby. My brother. We're all very close, and it's really wonderful.
Yeah, it's also very unusual in this day and age, especially, you know, I'm from the northeast of Scotland, and all of my family is over there. I really have no family here, so this is quite remarkable, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I hear from a lot of people that they're either they live away from their families or they don't have that same closeness. And it is interesting, you know, just to see how differently people's lives are. But I feel very fortunate. Like I said, I have a very close family, and they're all very supportive, no matter what I want to do. My mother, in fact, has been probably my biggest cheerleader with me writing, and especially I'll be leaving government at the end of the year. Well, I'll still be on the town board of Rhinebeck, but I'll be leaving Senator Gibson's office at the end of the year. And it's something that I decided to do earlier this year when I started the playwriting workshops, because it became clear to me that I really wanted my future to be a future with writing. And my mother was one of the most supportive people. Other people were like, are you crazy? You have great retirement, state jobs. But my mother was like, no, Elaine, you've always been a writer. This is what you should be doing. And I think you're going to do great. And I think it's time. And so I'm very fortunate.
Well, it's certainly great for the people who are lucky enough to be in the playwriting workshop. And you also, there's something else coming up, the Short Play Festival at the Center for the Performing Arts in Rhinebeck.
Yes, and I have to tell you, I can't say enough about the Performing Arts Center, about how much I love not only the center, but the group of people there. When I first moved back here, I was doing a lot of volunteering for the Performing Arts Center. But prior to that, I was trying to find theaters that I could volunteer in, and the Center for Performing Arts really, really embraced me and really gave me an opportunity to learn as much as I wanted to. I did the assistant stage managing for A Christmas Carol. I photographed some of their plays, and all on my own. I mean, not for any other reason, but for the love of theater. But they let me, which was the wonderful thing. And it seems like anything I wanted to do, they found a way to support that. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate it, because one of the unfortunate things that I discovered when I was looking for theaters to be involved in is that, you know, most people seem to have a role they needed you to fill for them. There wasn't that openness of, hey, you want to volunteer? That's a wonderful thing. Like, come on in. And like, people didn't necessarily embrace that concept. The Performing Arts Center did, and I learned a lot through them, and I really have grown to love each and every one of them. And I have to say, Lou Trapani, Barbara Melzer, Andy Weintraub, like, they're just some of the most terrific people I've met. And I actually contacted them shortly after I started the playwriting group to find out if we could do a short play festival there. You know, they have the larger stage. The Morton is wonderful, but their stage is limited, and the acoustics and the seating. Whereas the Performing Arts Center, that's what they do. They have performances there. And they, again, were very open and embraced it. And so it's going to be Mother's Day weekend, May 8th through the 10th. We will have the short play festival Friday through Sunday. And again, there'll be shorter plays, as the name implies. But the difference between the kind of plays we'll be doing at the Performing Arts Center versus the Morton is that the Morton will be staged readings. Performing Arts Center will be full performances. And we are allowing up to one act plays to be considered, whereas the Morton, we can only do 10-minute plays. And the main difference between a one act and a 10-minute is that a one act can run up to 45 minutes long. They're longer. They can be longer. So that's what the Performing Arts Center is.
Okay, that's good to know for anybody out there listening and wants to get involved and wants to submit that play that you've been working on. Is there anything else that you'd like to add, Elaine?
Just that I feel like I've been very fortunate and privileged to be around so many incredibly creative people. I feel like I go home from the workshops and I can't, you know, it can be 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and I could be going since 4:30 a.m. that morning, which is a typical day for me. And I'm so wired with energy when I get home, just listening to all the creativity and all of the work that comes up at the workshops. And I feel grateful. I feel inspired and I feel grateful. So this is something that I feel like I get so much from. So I'm very happy that we're all doing it. It's truly a collaborative process, and I just thank everybody who's involved.
And I second the collaborative process. As a member, I want to thank you on behalf of everyone for all your energy and all your ideas, and for starting this group, because it's been absolutely fabulous. And all of us, I think, have grown so much as writers, as playwrights. And just now, once again, where can people find out about this? Like, you have a website.
Yes, it's www.hudsonvalleyplaywrights.com. So that's plural, www.hudsonvalleyplaywrights.com. Information on the Morton is up there. Information on the Short Play Festival, including an application, is on the website, and also guidelines for getting involved. I do want to say, too, the Morton Library. When I contacted the Morton Library to use them as a venue space, I like I said, I grew up there, so I knew that the stage was there. I knew there were performances there in the past. My heart and home is in Rhinecliffe, and I really wanted to be able to do the workshops there. And the Morton Library was extremely generous, very happy to have us there, and they have been tremendously helpful throughout this entire process, and they remain generous. They continue to be generous all the time with allowing us to use rehearsal space, use the library during hours that it's closed. We're using their electricity. We're using their heat. And they're thrilled to have us there. And one of the reasons that we're doing the benefit for them is a huge thank you to really thank them for their generosity, because we really appreciate it.
Okay. And once again, that was Elaine Fernandez, who's the founder of the New Hudson Valley Playwrights. They're having a benefit for the Morton Library on January 17th and 18th and a short play festival in May. Thank you so very much for being on Between the Lines.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate being here.
Listening to WGXC at 90.7 FM. I'm Anne Forbes Cooper on Between the Lines. As I said earlier, this is going to be my last show for a while. It's been a terrific run, and I do hope to keep contributing to WJXC in other ways. WJXC, it's a terrific community radio station. We've come a long way, and I have learnt a lot about community radio, about radio, and about the fantastic people of this area. I'm very grateful to have had the opportunity. I've been lucky enough to meet and interview so many memorable personalities, from well-known names like Stanley Crouch, the jazz critic, authors Ed Breslin, Ruth Reichel and Susan Orlean, to the acclaimed local landscape artist Stanley Maltzman, still painting at 93 years old. I've interviewed a myriad of musicians, such as our own multimedia artist Brian Duane, Woodstock's Professor Louis and the Chromatics, and the wonderfully talented jazz pianist and composer Aaron Deal. As an actor and playwright myself, I've loved covering the theatre, and I focused on many different aspects of it, from an interview with writer and director Joseph Capone and his work with the classics at the Point, to Laura Lee Ecobelli, one of the area's most beloved actors with her Blue Horse Repertory Company, and the superb playwright and actor Brian Petty, who pours his heart and soul into everything he does. And then there's the exciting new development of the Bridge Street Theatre in Catskill, started by the directing acting team of John Soule and Steve Patterson. That launched this last summer with a series of performances, music and theatre, and promises to be one of the highlights of Catskill. I've interviewed politicians such as Vince Seeley, the Catskill Village President. I've covered Hurricane Irene, heading out with a recorder the day after to talk to local folks and businesses about the impact the storm had on their lives. I tried to comment on international affairs, checking in with friends in London during the media hoopla over the royal wedding back in 2011. And more recently, I took the pulse of some Scottish folk on the recent vote on independence. But more than anything, I've tried to keep it local, reporting on the people in and around my beloved Catskill, because this is what community radio is all about, uncovering the stories and experiences that might never get told otherwise. And I do want to pay tribute to some of the personalities who've appeared as guests on my show. I want to thank the copywriting powerhouse of Nina Sklansky of the Catskill Action Team for her tireless efforts to create a branding campaign, a slogan, It's Only a River, Get Over It, and the website Catskill the Village, all part of her aim to relaunch the village as an entity separate from the Catskill region. And as a 10-year resident of Catskill, I'm actually proud to have been a small part of that revitalisation campaign. It's still a work in progress, but with so many new restaurants, businesses and artistic projects in the works, it's an exciting time to live in the village. I also want to thank Nina again and Bob Hoven for the work they do for one of our local treasures, the Beattie Powers House, which is a very lively part of the local social scene. Thanks also to Betsy Jacks, Executive Director of the Thomas Cole Historic Site, who, along with her board of directors, headed by the incomparable Lisa Fox Martin, has done so much to re-establish the importance of Thomas Cole, founder of the Hudson River School of Painting, and also helping putting our little village of Catskill on the national art map. And I want to thank so many other people. I want to thank all the yogis, the filmmakers, the photographers, the historians, the local business owners, such as Dina Burston of Catskill Studio and Christy Gibson of Magpie Books, and Kay Stamer and Fawn Potash and Patrick Milburn, the artist, and geologist Bob Titus, and so many others who have all consented to be on my show. I want to thank my previous co-hosts, John McInerney and Paul Smart, and I want to thank WGXC. At a time way back in the depths of the 2008-2009 recession, when the village wasn't doing so well or looking so hot, WGXC came along, and it was one of the bright spots on the horizon with its input of energy, talent and creativity. And most of all, I want to thank you, the listener, for sharing your time, sharing your ears. I'm going to take a quick break and then I will be right back with one last hurrah. I'm Anne Forbes-Cooper. You're listening to Between the Lines on WGXC.
I put a spell on you because you're mine. You better stop the things you do. I tell you, I ain't lying. Stand it, you're running around, you know better, daddy. I can't stand it, cause you put me down. Oh, I put a spell on you. Because you're mine. Oh,
welcome back to Between the Lines. I'm Anne Forbes-Cooper. Usually at this time in the programme, I do a reading. And this time I thought I'd read from my own memoir, a memoir of my family and growing up in Scotland in the 1950s and 60s. It's called Take Two Dried Eggs. When my mother May died 3 years ago, lost in the fog of Alzheimer's, I inherited, along with her fine bone china tea service and her collection of peach-coloured lipsticks, her recipe books. Well, largely because no one else wanted them, actually. Amassed over a lifetime of cooking for family and friends in the northeast of Scotland, they were hardly collector's items in the culinary canon. And they ranged from the mandatory, to a Scot anyway, Dundee Homecraft book compiled by a committee of domestic science teachers. Haggis, anyone? Take one sheep's pluck.
the recipe began, though I don't remember my mother or anyone else attempting such an ambitious feat. And then there were wartime relics like the housewife's book. Housekeeping is not as easy and straightforward as some people imagine, it warns. And they also included local books about Scottish cuisine. No, that's not a non sequitur, of which my mother was a devotee. But my favourite was the handwritten collection that she began in 1944. It opens with chocolate crispies, and which starts with the ingredient 2 tablespoonfuls of dried egg, recorded in a wine-coloured hard-covered requisitioned accounts book and rendered in Mum's elegant cursive loops, the words glide across yellowing, blue-lined, satiny foolscap via the inky conduit of a fountain pen. Brown splodges and stains testify to the popularity of individual recipes. Just the silky feel and musty scent of the pages instantly transport me back to 7 Rosland Terrace, the house in the older part of Aberdeen, a fishing port, agricultural centre, shipbuilding and textile city, where I and several previous generations of the Forbes clan grew up. They'd transport me back to a time when it was quite common to have several generations of the same family live under the same roof, and when the parameters of daily existence were geographically bordered by a 3-mile radius within which contained all that one might need for a satisfying, fulfilling life. And they included the houses of friends and extended family, a school, a church, the grocer's shop, the butcher's, the chip shop, the sweetie shop, the baker's, the fishmonger's, probably a theatre, maybe the pictures. And, in the case of my stonemason dad, John, his workplace, to which he walked or cycled every day. Such tactile sensations, rediscovered decades later, stirred up in me longings for experiences long gone by, and so very different from my own peripatetic existence. With Mum gone, I'll never know exactly when, in 1944, she recorded that first recipe for the crunchy, gooey cocoa concoction that later became my favourite. But I like to imagine it was June the 6th. In June the 6th, 1944, the world was a tumultuous, dangerous place. World War II had been raging in Europe for 5 years, and my 25-year-old mother was pregnant with her first child, my older sister Norma. By June, Mum was no longer driving the ambulance that was part of her wartime civil defence duties, picking up the casualties of the Luftwaffe's bombing raids. But she still tramped the 2 miles, there and back, to her job at the photo processing studio. Mum was the family's recorder and chronicler of events, lest they be lost to the universe. And I picture her scribbling away, seated at the table in the middle of the huge, bustling, noisy downstairs kitchen that was the household's heart. I can see her pausing occasionally to look out through the window above the sink, out at the outhouses and cellars and beyond, to the washing green, the vegetable patches, the endless beds of rockeries, the roses that stretched to the summer house at the back of the garden, and swirling around her the rest of the Forbes clan. Older sister Hetty was already a war widow with 3 kids under 7, and there was 18-year-old brother Arthur, ruled ineligible for war because of a stomach ulcer, and who drove a long-distance lorry. Patriarch Grandpa Forbes, meanwhile, was quietly plotting his burgeoning bookie empire, an ambition constrained only by the war and lack of available punters. One day he would have the biggest bookie business in Aberdeen, but back then he operated out of just one wee office and was dependent upon runners placing the bets. And finally, presiding over everything and everyone, was Grandma Forbes, large and indomitable in a wraparound apron, metal curlers kept in place by a hairnet, and never without a dish towel in her hand, based on the theory that with such a large family, there were always dishes to be dried. Assorted dogs, cats and budgies made up the rest of the cast of characters. Meanwhile, at 7:15 a.m. on June 6th, my father, a combat engineer in the British Royal Engineers, Scottish Division, was storming Gold Beach across the Channel in Normandy, deactivating German mines. Only later would the family have heard about it, gathered round the radio on the kitchen sideboard, tuned to BBC, listening to the announcers delivering the news and waiting for the follow-up by Winston Churchill himself. I can almost smell the phenols and the ink of Mum's fountain pen that would be competing with the muttony odour from the pot of Scotch broth bubbling on the gas fire, the fumes from the coal fires lit even in early summer, often in every room, and the smoke from Grandpa's cigarette. And then there were the noises, kids shrieking and dogs barking and budgies chirping, and Grandma's endless reprimands to some unfortunate infant, dog, cat or husband. Stop doing that. Oh me, you'll be the death of me. And all punctuated by the occasional wailing of the air raid sirens, a signal for my grandmother to dive under the bed in the back bedroom and for everyone else to rush out to the cellars at the back of the house. After that first recipe for chocolate crispies came one for Australian cookies, a kind of biscuit made out of cornflakes or oats, and that was followed by sponge cake and queen cakes, tiny individual sponges decorated with desiccated fruit, Scottish gingerbread using Lyle's syrup, and doughnuts and ginger snaps and shortbread and coconut fingers and coffee meringues and puddings galore. Eve's pudding, stewed apples on the bottom, topped with chewy sponge cake and served with homemade custard. And there was bread and butter pudding in baked Alaska, and ice cream and meringue baked in the oven, and orange chiffon pudding and winter milk pudding and plum pudding made months in advance, and coconut tapioca. And then there were the soups, cream of carrot and leek and potato, and casseroles galore of mutton and of sausage roly-poly and macaroni kedgeree, and so on and so on. To my mother, cooking for an extended family must have offered a form of comfort and control in a world gone mad, as well as demanding a triumph of resourcefulness and ingenuity over the realities of food rationing. That was an excerpt from a memoir, Take Two Dried Eggs. And I want to thank you again for listening. And the playlist, before I forget, the playlist, very important for today, was right at the beginning, Sarah Bareilles, Between the Lines. And then there was Brian Ferry's latest album, CD, Avon Moore, or Avon Moore, followed by Annie Lennox from her new album, Nostalgia, You Put a Spell on Me. And taking us out is The Real-Time Kaylee. Thanks for listening. Thanks for everything. I'm signing off. Anne Forbes Cooper, this has been Between the Lines. Over and out. Thank you.